break open doors, leading you down into my core. Oh, I've become so
welcome, this is Road Warrior Radio, and you are tuned in live this Monday, May 24th, 2010, on the one and only Republic Broadcasting Network. We had a couple of rebroadcasts of Road Warrior Radio last week, and I'll just say, family preempted, I mentioned the concert that I attended, which was excellent, and I always enjoy those, kids' concert, high school concert, which was a lot of fun. Friday was a little bit different, similar circumstances, which precipitated the rebroadcast. Anyway, I appreciate your patience. This week is going to be exciting. We're going to kick the week off with the entire playing of Jaron Lanier's talk, You Are Not a Gadget, about his book of the same title, You're Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. And again, Jaron Lanier is a visionary in the technology industry, has been for a number of decades now, actually. He's known as the father of virtual reality technology and has worked on the interface between computer science and all different kinds of industry, medicine, physics, neuroscience, etc. He's a brilliant guy. He's obviously a genius. You can tell when you read or you listen to him. You read what he's written or you listen to him. And You Are Not a Gadget is his first book. He was a child prodigy back in the days when they first started talking about this subject matter, and now he is a self-described apostate in his community, so to speak. Why? Because he is outspoken about this nonsense called singularity and this anti-humanist movement. In other words, this effort to bend everyone's efforts in the technology world into creating this strange, ubiquitous super intelligence or super consciousness, this artificial intelligence that will eventually attain consciousness. And then, of course, at that point, the concept of singularity tells us that we can download ourselves into our laptops and we'll all live forever, which Lanier points out is very similar to the Christian concept of the rapture. And many people, including folks on this network, have pointed out that's a fairly new concept on the Christian timeline. So where did all of this come from? We're going to hear straight from Jaron Lanier right after this break. We'll jump right into the clip. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Attention RBN listeners. The Freeze Dry Guy, providing the finest in long-term storage food since 1970. Today, the U.S. military and the U.S. submarine service enjoy using these products extensively. In actual scientific tests, these foods typically maintain their high nutritional value in excess of 30 years. These foods are delicious tasting, hearty, light to carry, and easy to prepare under the most adverse conditions. Unfortunately, many people building a family food storage program, as well as many companies providing emergency feeding programs, simply do not give you enough protein, especially animal protein. No other food satisfies like animal protein during stressful times. If you're a meat eater, you will definitely want our freeze-dried meats and entrees, but we do offer vegetarian items as well. Visit freezedryguide.com or call 866-404-FOOD, 866-404-3663. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Did you ever wish that you could have done something while you still had the chance? What will you do if your income ends tomorrow? Or if you lose your home, as many already have? Do you have enough money to survive through an economic depression? If you don't want to gamble with your future, then FreeToProsper.com can help you quickly end your debt problems, protect your property and possessions, and develop a personal strategy to get you through the hard times. Most importantly, you get to keep your money and not pay another cent to creditors. Our program is often superior to bankruptcy, consolidation, or settlement. Visit FreeToProsper.com to find out more. This is your real chance to act ahead, so don't delay. Your future may depend on it. Call 718-615-0123 to learn more. That's 718-615-0123. Or visit freetoprosper.com today.
Don't answer it.
If fear strikes your heart when the phone rings, knowing it may be another bill collector, it's time for you to call Zero Debt in 90 Days. 800-477-9256. Settlements, bankruptcy, and attorneys are not the answer and may end up costing you up to 10 times more than necessary. Listen, if you're already in debt, does it make sense to get buried in another payment plan? Zero Debt in 90 Days gets you out of debt in 90 days guaranteed without a payment plan and without attorneys or going to court. Get the fastest relief from debt on the planet when you call 800-477-9256. If you have debt with the IRS, credit cards, student loans, or a foreclosure, we can help at Zero Debt in 90 Days, and we are the only organization to provide written guarantees on the results. Go to ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com. That's ZeroDebtGuaranteed.com. Or call now for free information. 800-477-9256. That's 800-477-9256.
All right, welcome back. All right, we're going to jump straight into this. And believe me, if you haven't heard this, even if you have, it's interesting. I highly recommend the book by Jaron Lanier. It's Off the Beaten Path. I don't hear enough people talking about it, I think, and the concepts discussed in it. You Are Not a Gadget. There's a link to it in last week's, actually it's 2 weeks ago now, Friday, May 14th's archive, a link to the book there, and there's also a link to the video that we're going to play now, the clip from YouTube in last Thursday, May 20th's archive for Road Warrior Radio on republicbroadcasting.org, and you can find that link there. I'll make sure that we put another link to the video in tonight's archive as well. But again, just a little bit about Jaron Lanier. A Silicon Valley visionary since the 80s, was among the first to predict the revolutionary changes of the World Wide Web that it would bring to commerce and culture. Now, in his first book, You're Not a Gadget, a manifesto, written more than two decades after the web was created, Lanier offers this provocative and cautionary look at the way the web is transforming our lives for better or for worse. And he challenges us. The current design and functionality of the web have become so familiar that it's easy for us to forget that they grew out of programming decisions made decades ago, and the web's first designers made crucial choices, such as making one's presence anonymous, for example, that have had enormous and often unintended consequences. What's more, these designs quickly become locked in, quote-unquote, as a permanent part of the web's very structure. And Lanier discusses the technical and cultural problems that can grow out of a poorly considered digital design, and ones that our financial markets and sites like Wikipedia, Facebook, and Twitter are elevating the wisdom of mobs, which is an oxymoron, obviously. It's a paradox. And computer algorithms over the intelligence and judgment of individuals, among a number of other things. He makes some very lucid and salient points, and we're going to hear those now. Like I said, I highly recommend the book. I think that section in chapter 2 that I read going back 2 weeks ago regarding the confluence of the concepts of the rapture and the singularity and how they're basically the same concept, they just reach out to different demographics, should be fascinating and horrifying at the same time to most people. So anyway, without further ado, we're going to get through most of Jaron Lanier's talk that's on YouTube, You Are Not a Gadget. Talk about his book of same title. So here we go.
Normally, I separate my musical and technical and literary lives, but recently I've gotten requests to bring some of the unusual instruments I play to my lectures, and I've started doing that, and it seems to go well, so I thought I would try it tonight. This is an instrument from Laos called a can. It's the first example, I believe, of a design in human history that involves a sequence of similar objects that can be turned on or off, which are these pipes. And so I think this is the prototype of digital memory. And in fact, in ancient Greek times, it traveled from China across the Silk Route to Greece, was copied by the Romans into the extraordinary noisemaker called the hydraulis in the Colosseum that accompanied horrific gore, evolved into the pipe organ, and specifically a player pipe organ, because the hydraulis was too large to be operated manually, and so it was operated with planks, which eventually turned into the keyboard. And the player pipe organ evolved into the player piano, and an improvising player piano inspired the Jacquard loom, which inspired the programmable calculator and then the computer. So it is, in one story, which could easily be contradicted, the prototype for the computer. I'll just play a little bit on it and then talk. Other unusual instruments with me that I'll play at the show on Wednesday. The strangest one, though, unquestionably, will be the piano, which still strikes me as being profoundly odd and an expression of a particularly exotic culture. So this book and the recent dialogues I've been having about it are profoundly difficult and odd for me because I've become an apostate, in a sense, within my community. And I'd like to start by saying a little bit about that. If we go back to much earlier times, say about 30 years ago, I went through a period where somehow I had learned how to take on a guru-like quality in my talks, and I got people very, very excited about the coming wonders of digital technology. I copied the cant and rhetorical techniques of Alan Watts, if anyone remembers him, but applied them. Does anybody? Nobody remembers Alan Watts? That's very sad. He's a particularly eloquent Brit, but at any rate, I developed an ability to be quite seductive and to create excitable audiences, and it was wonderful. And I think a lot of what I believed in, I continue to believe, and it was quite legitimate. Inevitably, in essentially trying to launch not just a cultural movement, but the instrumentation to make that cultural movement more real, in a sense, than other cultural movements, because it was actually turned into code. It was actually turned into the gadgets of civilization. It was more than words. In order to launch something like that, inevitably, we had to make some hypotheses about what would work. My feeling is that a bold hypothesis, a bold experiment, is nothing to be ashamed of. But there is shame to be had if results start coming in, if data starts coming in, and one refuses to acknowledge that data. And I think we're at that moment of truth now where we have to decide if we're empiricists or not, if we're willing to look at the results of some of the ideas and assess what's working and what's not working, and if we're willing to acknowledge when things aren't working. And a very obvious example for me is one piece of rhetoric that while it might sound counterintuitive, if you give the fruits of your brain away, give away your journalism, give away your music, the internet will be so bountiful in its rewards to you that you'll do better afterwards. And this idea is something that we used to talk about with a religious sensibility almost. It still has that quality. Chris Anderson's book Free is out now, for instance. There's still people who are promoting this notion from the old days. When I look at the data of what's going on in real people's lives, I see an absolutely negative outcome. I see evidence that consistently shows that idea to not be delivering. And one can ask whether we've waited long enough. Perhaps if we waited, the web is now about 17 years old. We could wait another 17 years. We could wait 170 years. And surely at some point it would change. But there's this question of how long one is willing to wait before deciding these are results that matter. And my feeling is that a generation of people matters, and that's what we have here. And so I feel I must look at the data and accept that this is an idea that is wrong, that's been disproven by data. So now I suddenly find myself in this position of being the naysayer, and it is a far less rewarding and pleasant position to be in than being the sort of prophet kid who gets people excited. That was more fun. The audiences were a bit loonier, but they were charming. And I want to propose, though, that if you look carefully at what I say, what my book says, what I say in my talks about this topic, I think you'll see that within my pessimism about these recent results and within my criticism is actually a profound wellspring of optimism about human nature, human potential, and the future. I'm saying that we should expect a lot from ourselves. And furthermore, within the boosterism of the people who oppose my ideas the most, within the Web 2.0 people and the artificial intelligence people and post-humanist, singularity-obsessed people, within all of these movements, you see what on the surface looks like boosterism and positivity, but underneath is a profound skepticism of human potential and a profound dismissal of human nature as a good thing, as something to be furthered. So I think I'm still playing the role of the optimist. It's just that the situation has become a little more complex and twisted. I'd like you to say a little bit about the stealth pessimisms and optimisms involved. In my case, The biggest optimism is the one in the title. I'm proposing that we should think of people as being more than machines.
What really gets in the way of your goals and dreams? Time? Money? Education? Well, if it's all of the above, Ashworth College is for you. Ashworth can help you achieve your goals by letting you study at your own pace, online, anywhere, anytime. Your computer is your classroom. With programs as low as $39 a month, Ashworth College is one of the most affordable online schools out there. Just $39 a month. Plus, Ashworth offers over 100 nationally accredited college programs, such as criminal justice, healthcare, technology, and business. You could earn as much as $300,000 more than those without an associate's degree. No high school diploma? Well, Ashworth even offers high school completion programs. So call an Ashworth Career Advisor right now, toll free at 1-866-504-8173. That's 1-866-504-8173. Or go to ashworthtraining.com.
Aerial spray, chemtrails, the modified atmosphere. Heavy metals and pesticides, carcinogens and chemical fibers all falling from the sky. You have a choice to keep your body clean. Detoxify with microplant powder from hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608. It's odorless and tasteless and used in any liquid or food. Protect your family now with microplant powder. Cleaning out heavy metals, parasites, and toxins. Order it now for daily intake and stock it now for long-term storage. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
Attention, ladies! Dr. Arthur Perry is inviting you to participate in a nationwide giveaway of his Miracle Cream Night Skin. If you want smooth, firm skin with healthy collagen and elastin, you are eligible for a free 10-day supply of Night Skin, the skincare formula with proven results. Night Skin works while you sleep to even skin tones on your face and neck, exfoliate, and also reduce the appearance of fine lines. This one amazing cream does the work of four expensive products. If you want firmer, beautiful skin, and you're new to Dr. Perry's Night Skin, you're eligible to have a free 10-day supply rushed to your door. Here's how.
For your free 10-day supply of Night Skin, call 1-800-362-5848. You only pay shipping and handling. Call right now and ask for your free supply of Night Skin. Call 1-800-362-5848 and be sure to click on our banner at www.republicbroadcasting.org.
Now, this is an enormously controversial idea within the technical communities because there's an influential religious movement now, and it's the only thing that it can be called, that hopes to find eternal life and the other benefits of religion precisely through believing that people and machines are the same. And the specific mechanism is that during an event that might come up a decade from now or something like that, the computers are supposed to become so smart that they take over the planet and they become so capacious that they can scoop up all our brains and give us eternal life within a digital simulation or something like that. And these ideas, rather than being fringy, are very mainstream in the technical world and extraordinarily influential. There's a university called the Singularity University devoted to nothing but teaching this theology that's next door to Google and has full attendance. Despite it being quite expensive. And it's extraordinary to me how just loony, how off-kilter that stuff is. But at any rate, what I propose in the book is that even though there's no absolute test or absolute confirmation of any hypothesis about whether people and machines are ultimately the same or different, if we don't believe that people are supernaturally better than machines, will write crap software. And the reasons for that I explain in the book. But essentially, I propose that we should make a divide between people and the rest of nature. We should say, we should take a naturalist approach to studying nature in general, but we should treat ourselves supernaturally especially when we're designing technology, because it's the only way to create designs that show adequate respect for us, that we avoid the danger of lessening what we could be through inappropriately low expectations. I think there's absolutely no excuse for not having the highest expectations of ourselves on every level, especially in the longer term. So in that sense, I think this sort of technological humanism I propose is vastly more optimistic about people than the sort of everything is computation ideology, which gives us no special place. Now, there are a variety of other optimisms. In order to propose that in the long-term future we should have a world in which people can earn dignity, can earn royalties on the fruits of their own brain work, as opposed to selling T-shirts or the other things that are proposed to musicians and journalists who are put out of work by the current design of the Internet. If people are to live off their brains, that has embedded in it an optimism that people will have interesting things to do with their brains. Embedded in the open culture idea, which proposes that people give away their stuff for free and find ever more physical and drudgerous ways to make a living as technology progresses, that alternative has essentially a pessimistic idea about people, because it proposes that essentially it's more important to have free access to consumption, that being a consumer is more important than being a producer, that there are more people who would like to consume than would like to produce, so therefore the rights of the consumers and getting things for free should trump the rights of the producers. But my optimism, which has been borne out empirically, by the way, by activity on the web, is that vast numbers of people, in fact the majority, are producers. And in the long term, if we're inadequately optimistic about ourselves on that question, we will create a duller world and a duller future for ourselves than we deserve. So it's very important to err on the side of optimism about ourselves. And that's essentially the core argument in my book. And it's very important to be aware of when there are stealthy forms of pessimism about ourselves, even if they're packaged in terminology and style that makes them seem as if they're full of positivity. They often really aren't. So this is my odd situation at the moment. It's made more odd by the fact that the people I criticize are not in any sense distant from me, but are my neighbors. Chris Anderson, who wrote Free, is literally my neighbor, and the people who disagree with me on this are the people I work with every day and see socially every day. This is my immediate community. I think it's nothing I say here is a surprise to them, of course, because I've been writing essays about this sort of stuff for years, so they know that I've been gradually going astray. and they look at me with increasing alarm, I think. and that's okay. There are a couple of things worth noting, which also serve to reinforce my sense of optimism. One is that I haven't been ostracized. My world remains a friendly one. I haven't lost friendships over this. I still feel close to some of the figures in the book who I disagree with the most, and I still have friendly connections with some of the others. I think this bodes well. I had been wondering what would happen when this book was published, because it was bringing this argument to a wider audience. And rather than a flood of condemnation, I have instead received an extraordinary flood of support from the technical world, which has surprised and astonished me and has made me quite happy. So I think we can turn this around, and I think we must turn it around. There will inevitably be a generation of people who strongly identify with the ideas that I'm criticizing, not because of what the ideas say or whether they're true or not, but simply because they're part of the perfume of their lives, of their generation, of their identity. And somebody whose whole identity has been in growing up in the Pirate Party or something like that is not going to say, oh, this book shows me that these ideas are wrong, because the truth is that no one is strong enough to give up ideas that have become more than ideas to them.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Heart-related health problems affect millions of people each year. Maybe you're one of the many who suffer from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeat, or clogged arteries. There is a solution that doesn't involve expensive prescription drugs that only mask the problem and leave you with horrible side effects. Doctors who have tried Heart and Body Extract with their patients are thrilled with the results as well. Here's what Dr. Goodman has to say about his experience with the product.
If you notice that most times you hear these drug ads on TV, they have a list of possible side effects. I find that if you're going to take something that is, you're trading one problem for five or six other problems, that to me doesn't make sense. And using something that is natural, that is absorbed into the body, particularly because it's in a liquid form, I think is the best way to go.
Call to order your 2 month supply of Heart and Body Extract today. Call 1-866-295-5305 or go to hbextract.com.
Today in America, you are facing threats of bank holidays, currency devaluation, confiscation of funds by lawyers and various government entities. We at Panama Legal Offshore Law Firm based in Guatemala have offshore solutions. For instance, we can form an anonymous Hong Kong corporation for you, get you a bank account, a $1 trillion Hong Kong bank that'll let you own 10 different currencies in your account. If one or two currencies go down, the others will go up. You'll have no Hong Kong taxes, strong bank secrecies, no tax treaty with the USA, no need to go to Hong Kong, access your funds online from anywhere in the world, and you can even get an anonymous Visa card without your name on it or in the strip through us. So come visit us at PanamaLaw.org. That's www.PanamaLaw, one word, PanamaLaw.org. And you can chat with us on Skype or use our encrypted chat and discuss your needs. Thank you.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
It has found value in the form of identity, connection with others, or simply a means of perceiving what they view as the warmth and good of the world. For someone in that situation, we should expect it to take maybe 10 or 20 years for them to change their ideas. And I think that this is just human nature. I think changing ideas that are more than ideas is one of the hardest and most noble things a person can do, and it does take decades. And this is what we must expect from people who go off the deep end on some religion or other, or some crazy nationalism or other or whatever, or for that matter, on some crazy cyber ideas. It does take a while, and I realize that in saying that, it might only increase the perception that I'm being arrogant in assessing my opponents, and I'm sorry if it comes off that way, but I do think that that's the case. And so I accept that for some people, the things I'm saying will never make sense for some, well, will not make sense for some good long time, and that is simply the way of things. I think there's an extraordinary project ahead of us, which is to imagine a path from the internet as it's come to be thus far to where it needs to be in the longer term. And it's going to be a difficult, strange path, and I don't know how to get us to a more sustainable or more humane design. In the book, I propose five or six ideas for how to get us going, but I think it is quite unclear to me. One of my thoughts has been to wait for MIDI's piece and then find whoever the key players were in it and bring them into this and say, okay, try to untangle this mess. I want to address my friends at Google and say, you know, I've known you guys a long time, and just geek to geek, why don't you guys give up the advertising model? It's bad for humanity. But, of course, it's one of the most profitable things that has ever been done in the history of business, so getting them to give it up will not be easy. And yet, I actually do hope to convince them of that. I'd like to talk them into giving that up. I think they could do much better with something that is rewarding what people think instead of how people can manipulate each other in tawdry and silly and arbitrary ways. I think that expression is more important than yellow teeth. I can't imagine quite how we'll get from where we are to where we need to be, but I think it's inevitable that we will get there. Predicting, say, the next 10 years of technology is hard, but predicting the next 50 years is easier because the choice space isn't that large. We simply must create a society in which people can live off their brains, in which expression matters, in which people think of themselves as being supernaturally special so as not to preclude the possibility that we might be. If we don't do that, we'll end up in a really dull world or a really phony world where we're all living in the service of an imaginary computer-based God. And I don't want those futures, and I am fundamentally optimistic that we will avoid those stupid futures, and that's why I'm quite certain that we'll find our way to the futures that can work. I just don't know how long it will take. And I'm sorry, I must ask you for feedback about how long I've been going. It seems like that's about 25 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, you've got a few more minutes if you'd like to say more. There's plenty to address if you don't.
Okay, I'll conclude then with a very simple thought. There's a negative way to restate what I just said, which might be worth, I prefer stating things positively, but sometimes stating things in a cautionary tone and an alarmist tone gets through a little bit better, so it's always worth a try. So I'm going to try putting it in a different way. If you look at the history of people and technology, it's easy to discern what we might call a ramp of progress, where technology gets more and more capable. Now, the interesting thing about this ramp is that with every new capability comes both benefits and perils, not necessarily in equal measure all the time, but the increase in peril is undeniable. And let me point out, for instance, that in very early times, say when people were hunter-gatherers, very small numbers of people could do damage to small numbers of people, and that was the extent of violence. There might be one band that could murder another band of people, that sort of thing. With the advent of civilization, large numbers of people could do damage to large numbers of people. So you have the Greeks forming into a phalanx and plowing through an opposing army, and so forth. As technology increases, we start to see the phenomenon where small numbers of people can do damage to large numbers of people because they become empowered, and this takes place with the phenomenon like hedge funds and terrorists and so forth.
Nothing serious.
And what?
Nothing serious.
Okay. Now, what this tells me is that the ramp of what we could call progress for its own sake is increasingly perilous over time. And the model that I like to use in assessing it is provided to us by the philosopher James P. Carse, who wrote a book called Finite and Infinite Games. And the distinction is a very simple one. A finite game would be a single game of soccer that inevitably, at least thus far in history, comes to a conclusion eventually. But the overall field of soccer can continue indefinitely. And so that's the difference between a finite and an infinite game. And technological progress for its own sake, in my view, is a finite game for the simple reason that you can max out any form of capability. For instance, at the point where you have a single bomb that can destroy the planet or something like that, you reach a point of absurdity where further progress really doesn't have an effect on the situation. So it is actually a finite game, even though it's a very long one. It doesn't seem like it. However, there's another ramp which I perceive, which I would like to call the McLuhan ramp, in honor of Marshall McLuhan, which is a ramp in which connections between people become ever more deep, varied, sophisticated, profound, and empathic. And I would say an early milestone in the McLuhan ramp was the generation of language in humans, and then reading and writing, printing, the internet, and so forth. And I think if we imagine, where does that ramp go? And at the end of my book, I propose one idea of where it might go, which is called post-symbolic communication, which I won't attempt to explain right now. But if we imagine where it might go, we can imagine something that is a genuinely infinite game, because there's no end to the increase in subtlety of communication or closeness of contact or potential for empathy. And I think if you combine the two, you have something that's vastly more survivable. So another way to put this, which is what I sometimes tell students, is that there are times in the past where there have been voracious debates about what the purpose of art is, and there have also been debates about whether modernity is even a good idea, whether engineering is a fundamentally flawed sort of a thing to do. But I think at this point, there's an interesting answer to both debates that brings them together, that brings art and engineering into a single common cause. And it is that technologists and artists must create a future in which the adventures available to people through communicating with each other, through finding bridges over the mysterious and infinite nature of the interpersonal gap between us, the metaphysical interpersonal gap, in which the exploration of these crossings becomes so infinite and so seductive that it seduces us away from any technological tendency towards mass suicide or mass destruction. And if that sounds overly dramatic, I think in the book I go over a bit of how some of the technologies that I oppose bring out mob-like identities in people that I find quite scary in the long term, and I think with very good reason based on human history. So essentially we need to seduce ourselves into our own survival, and that is the project I advocate.
Thank you very much. There's some questions I want to ask Jaron about for about 10 minutes or so, and then I'm going to bring in questions from you and also from the Twitter sphere, dare I say, which will only be intelligent questions expressed in 140 characters or fewer, not including the hashtag. I'm sorry about this laptop. I'm a kind of digital kind of guy, and my iPad didn't arrive in time, so...
No, I'm very happy to see money being siphoned out of Britain to Silicon Valley.
Taiwan.
It warms my heart.
No, the affordances of this kind of device, largely created by Alan Kay, as it happens, are very good, but don't quite work for this format. So I just wanted to try and start off on a more positive note, if you like, than avoiding mass suicide and so on. And just try and ask you to characterize your vision of a future, particularly around the idea of creativity and human interaction related
Sure.
to creativity. What's the vision?
Well, there's a bit of a contradiction that one has to acknowledge here, which is I'd like to envision a future in which people are reinventing themselves on a constant basis, a future of continuous revolution in sort of the American terms of Jefferson. And therefore, for me to say much about it, I contradict myself intrinsically, right? But let me say, I think I could say a little bit about it in a general sense. There's a crucial end game approaching probably in the century, which has been foreseen for quite a while, and I think the most articulate observers of it were actually in the writing in the 19th century and the very early 20th century, and that is, how does society organize itself if technology really becomes quite good? Now, technology doesn't become good in some simple way. We have many technologically driven problems that must be solved in order to enjoy other technological solutions. Mm. So a dramatic example is climate change. And it's not the only one. We have an enormous number of problems that must be solved. We are a technological species, and we cannot retreat from the technological troubles we've gotten ourselves into. We will have to invent our way out of them. I actually think we will. In my own consideration of all the various problems, I feel quite optimistic that we will find solutions mm-hmm. to all of them. However, let's leave that aside. Obviously, if we don't, well, then that's that. You know, then we then we live in a very unfortunate future for quite some time indeed, and that's possible. We might bring on some sort of catastrophe on ourselves, and climate change isn't the only one. But let's, for the purpose of this discussion, let's assume that we can invent our way out of these problems. So then the next question is, well, if indeed technology is getting better, how exactly do people benefit from it? How do we organize our lives? And starting back in the 19th century, there were a number of thinkers who had the benefit of clarity of thought of somebody encountering problems early on. It's frequently the case that the first thought is the best thought. It's a phenomenon I explore in my book because I'm impressed enormously with people who wrote about the Internet before it existed, having, in a sense, superior clarity to people who were burdened by experience of it in order to think about it. Well, E.M. Forster is the most dramatic example. In his short story, The Machine Stops. If you haven't read it, immediately read the short story, The Machine Stops, by E.M. Forster, author of Room of the View and so forth. Writing a little over a century ago, he absolutely nailed the Internet as it is today, as a dystopian future. I mean, absolutely nailed it to smithereens and outwired, wired, it's astonishing. It might be the most single piece ever written about anything. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. But let me focus on some other thinkers first, because he was reacting to a conversation that was going on. So another cautionary tale was H.G. Wells's Time Machine. Mm-hmm. And so Wells considered a future in which the technology gets good enough for people to become indolent, and what happens is our race splits into two, where a small number of benefactors become screwed up in one way, and then those who are left out in the cold, the peasants, become screwed up in a different way. And neither fate is particularly noble. Mm. And that, I think, right now is our normative future. This is what the future we're building, and it's the one we should avoid. Mm. Forster's vision was of people becoming lost in the Internet and tweeting and so forth. And he really does describe all these things, and YouTube and whatnot. And he described all these things before Turing. Mm. It's really spooky. But his vision was that we become lost in a sort of a fake world and lose vitality and become dull. And that describes much of the present I'm criticizing. So both of these guys were right on it. But let me turn to another 19th century thinker, Karl Marx. So Marx writes about technology, essentially. I realized this once when I was driving in Silicon Valley, and I was listening to something on the radio going on and on about how international markets are falling and things are flowing about faster and capital is moving this way. And I thought, oh, God, more of this stupid Silicon Valley propaganda. I just can't stand this stuff. When will we learn to shut up around here? And it turned out to be an anniversary reading of Das Kapital. And then I went back and read the thing, and I was like, wow, actually, you can read Marx in a new light. And if you think of him as a technology writer, essentially, he was foreseeing exactly the same dilemma that Wells was concerned with. And he was saying, listen, you know, if technology is gradually getting better, we should plan ahead. So when the robots are good enough, instead of everybody starving from being made obsolete, we all benefit from it. And the problem with Marx's world is that he essentially fell into exactly the trap that E.M. Forster was ridiculing. There's a passage in Marx where he describes what life would be like when the machines are good, and everybody would loll about in lovely lawns, practicing archery and reading the classics. And in that nice little vision is the problem with Marx's approach, which is there has to be you're institutionalized, basically. It's an eternal rest home. Because what about...
To be fair, I think it was a Communist Manifesto, but he actually talked about people being a fisher in the morning and a poet in the afternoon. It was being creative rather than just consuming.
But the point is that his world is one in which he'd have to design and advance these roles. It would be a stultifying world. And the world I want is one of more fundamental reinvention of each individual, where I can't foresee what people would make of themselves. And that is a crucial problem with neo-Marxist visions. So they always involve this hope that one can foresee the hopes and dreams of others and plan for them. And that's a mistake. There's another world which was not articulated in the 19th century but was articulated in the 1960s by Ted Nelson, who was the first engineer to consider how the web could be built. And he called it hypertext, and the HT in HTML, which is the file format that Tim Berners-Lee gave us in order to start the web, refers back to hypertext, to Ted Nelson's vision. So there's a direct lineage.
By HTML, I think.
What?
Stay tuned for a million bottle giveaway announcement.
Do you have troubled skin, acne? Well, against the better judgment of our management team, we're going to prove to you once and for all that Proactiv works. So if you want to try it, give us a call, because we're going to let a million people try Proactiv and receive our legendary refining face mask free if you call right now.
You heard it. Be one of the first callers and you'll receive a 60-day trial of Proactiv Solution risk-free, plus a free refining face mask when you call 1-800-340-4634.
Proactiv's combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin.
You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial plus a free refining face mask. Call toll-free now, 1-800-340-4634. That's 1-800-340-4634.
Do you know the truth about cancer treatments? Do you realize that with all presently accepted methods, you are not correctly attacking the cancer and you are mostly fighting to survive the treatment? Do you realize that mutilating surgery, burning and poisoning of your entire system are totally unnecessary? But now it's cancer's turn to die with LaserMed Incorporated's patented methodology. Without cutting, bleeding, drugs, or damaging radiation, we can destroy skin cancer and breast tumors of any size without adverse side effects at our physician's office. Laser technology at its best. For more information, visit www.lasemedinc.com on the web. That's www.lasemedinc.com.
Call now, 501-255-0528. 501-255-0528. 501-255-0528.
Do you need help getting your child to behave? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'm willing to give away thousands of my best-selling total transformation programs for free. All you do is tell us how the program works for you and your family. Did it turn around your child's behavior? Did the screaming and arguing stop in your home? Is he doing better in school? The Total Transformation has helped hundreds of thousands of families. I want to see what it can do for you, and I'm willing to let you have it for free. Just order my program, use it with your child, then send me your feedback. I'll refund the purchase price of the program. You keep the Total Transformation program forever, for free. You don't have to struggle with your child's bad behavior one more day, because now you can try my Total Transformation, and the program will be free.
Limited number of free programs available. Call now. 1-800-583-1093. 1-800-583-1093. That's 1-800-583-1093.
Via the standard generalized markup language of the Pentagon era. I'm digressing, carry on.
You are indeed. But we're all impressed.
I'm impressed.
So Ted Nelson imagined a world in which there would be a universal system of micropayments so that people could constantly be paying each other to explore each other's dreams, visions, and so forth. And in doing that, even in a world of great plenty, people would have an opportunity to define themselves and carve out a region of liberty that would be unforeseeable by social planners or bureaucrats. And I think that sort of vision of some sort of eternal potential for people to invent their circumstances individually is the one that we really need to pursue. Mm. And the only way to do that is one in which people live off their brains and earn dignity, meaning intellectual property, in which they don't have to sing for their supper for every single meal, mm-hmm. but can actually find some form of sustenance from what they do with their brains. And that's precisely the thing we turned against in the open culture movement. And it didn't become clear to me what a gross mistake it was until the negative results came in. Anyway, I hope that answers the question.
Yes, that's a very, very enlightening answer. The phenomena you describe are quite profound. Do you see them being situated in as you've just perhaps alluded to, a broader changes in society which influence the way in which we design our software and our tools, and then that has an influence back on society? And in that sense, would you say that the sort of there's human agency there, even if it's not very positive, or do you actually see technology as having agency itself to affect human behavior?
I don't think technology has agency, or let me be more precise about that. I don't think in an absolute sense it's possible to answer the question of whether technology has agency, because agency is something that's perceived subjectively. That's what Turing ultimately taught us with the Turing test thought experiment. But I think that there are enormous pragmatic benefits to taking the position that agency does not, that technology does not have its own agency. Almost everyone who makes anti-human designs believes that technology is in charge, and that there's a kind of it's very much like the determinism that Marxists would use as a way to be cruel. There's this sort of if you believe that there are inevitable events, then you don't have to worry about their consequences, and you don't have to look at the data. And so that is precise. This belief in technology having its own agency is precisely the reason why it's possible for so many people to not look at the data, that our ideas aren't working. Now, I should also there's a personality type which identifies with the ideas I criticize, and this becomes a sort of a difficult and hard to talk about area, but I'll touch on it. There's a what we could call an Asperger's related cognitive style, and it eschews societal influence because it doesn't receive signals from people all that well. And so I don't think society's been influencing technological design so much, broader society. However, technological designs do influence. In fact, they practically dictate a great many societal designs. So the influence is almost entirely from the geeks outward, and there's very, very little influence from the outside society back to the geeks. Essentially, that's a feedback channel I'm attempting to open up with the book.
So, for instance, you talk about social networking not being, and this is my term, granular enough in terms of its understanding or representation of human relations. So you're either single or married. There's no way of defining your own sort of status in life, if you like, and in a way we adapt ourselves to those
right,
more... Is that an example of
what you're
talking
about? Point out that that's more of a problem for young people. There are a couple of things. The book, as I wrote it, was three or four times longer than it is, and there are a couple of cases where I compressed arguments, and I've been thinking perhaps I should have been a little bit more meticulous in making some distinctions. So in the case of social networking like Facebook, from a great many interactions with a great many people and also talking to people who've done research in this area, I think there is a difference.
With recent